And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds, and today will be no exception. My guest today, Joe Dallas, he is the Program Director of Genesis Counseling in Tustin, California. This is a Christian counseling service to men who are dealing with sexual addiction, dealing with homosexuality, and other sexual and relational problems. Joe Dallas, he once held the distinction of being listed by OC Weekly as one of Orange County's 50 scariest people. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but he's a member of the American Association of Christian Counselors. He's author of multiple books on human sexualities. We recommend every single one of them. You can find them on the web at equip.org. Let me list just a few of them: Desires in Conflict, The Gay Gospel, The Game Plan, one of my favorites, Speaking of Homosexuality. By the way, the subtitle there is Discussing the Issues with Kindness and Clarity. And then the most recent book, which we'll be discussing today, Christians in a Cancel Culture. Let me just read what I wrote about this book, because this is one of those books that I find absolutely axiomatic for everyone to read, whether you're a Christian or not. What I say about this book is Joe Dallas rightly dubs cancel culture a spreading madness, a virus of twisted thinking. Belief in the normalcy of the male-female sexual union is now being viewed as homophobic. The immutable nature of our assigned sex is considered transphobic, and the value of the unborn, misogynistic. The dam has burst, and it has submerged basic Christian morality and ethics. And yet, characteristically, Joe does not merely curse the darkness. He equips Christians in the art and science of conducting difficult discussions, wielding the Christ-mandated gavel of grace. Whenever I think of Joe Dallas, I think of that gavel of grace. He wields that gavel to perfection. Today's discussion on Hank Unplugged is wide-ranging. We're going to be talking about abortion, homosexuality, race, including critical race theory, transgenderism, and progressive Christianity. Of course, as always, whenever I talk to Joe, we'll probably get into much, much more. Joe, with that as an introduction, I am just delighted to have you back on Hank Unplugged.
Thanks so much. It is great talking with you again, Hank. Always.
Your book is phenomenal. In fact, let me say before I ask you a question about this book that this book is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. You can get a copy on the web at equip.org. Simply for standing with us, shoulder to shoulder. Get your copy, again, at equip.org. Joe, why write another book?
I didn't think I would write one like this, Hank, because I didn't think it would be necessary. I think many of us saw the signs coming, the signs of a growing hostility towards the Christian message. But I thought that hostility would be a social issue which would not be converted into restrictive actions or even laws. I thought it would just be an attitude, and that was naive of me. But by the time we got into 2020, we were seeing some pretty disturbing trends. We were seeing the green lighting of violent hostility towards viewpoints that have been traditionally held and even revered in our culture, and certainly in our churches. Principles about the nature of salvation, about what does or does not constitute racism, the value of unborn life, normal versus abnormal sexuality, the mutable or immutable nature of the sex we are assigned with, these all became the hot button issues. And if you were on what the culture now decided was the wrong side of these issues, there was a heavier price to pay than simple dislike or contempt. We found that people were making concerted efforts to silence us, and this was particularly true of the cultural powers that be, the powers that be in the social media and in academia and certainly in the news media. And so I realized that what I had experienced is just one little old counselor who tried to help people who wanted to overcome homosexuality and the opposition I got for that on that issue, I now realized was a much broader problem. It was the problem of a very general crusade, a very unreasonable crusade that is committed to converting the infidels. And the infidels in this case are those of us holding traditional viewpoints. Now, when you are running a crusade and you're dealing with infidels, you got to either convert them or you got to silence them. That is what we are facing when we're facing cancel culture. So in a nutshell, that's why I wrote the book.
Are we, in essence, looking at a neutered church today?
Oh, I hope not, Hank. I still hold out hope that there is, well, in fact, I know, there is the remnant. There are and always will be those who hold a high view of Scripture and who live out their life in faithfulness to God's will and who are unafraid to give the full counsel of God. That will always be true. But I do think we are seeing a general weakening of the church. It seems to me that a couple of things have happened. One, we have drifted further and further away from a disciplined study of the Word of God. And as a result, I think we're lacking in biblical discernment because you can't have discernment based on a document you're not familiar with. Secondly, I think we have drifted into the mistaken belief that our primary responsibility as churches is to be nice and to be liked. And as a result, I think we are soft-pedaling any truth that the culture may deem offensive, all in the name of winning the culture. And you know what that means, Hank? There's no way to win the culture without truth. You can only appease the culture.
You have a delicious turn of phrase in the book, chapter 2, titled Of Ravers and Cavers. And I want you to talk about that a little bit from the perspective of people in high positions, leaders of ministries, high position church leaders, they have mega churches and so forth, who are either raving or caving. Talk about what that means and how you can identify with that. In fact, I hope you get into, in answer to this question, how you yourself caved at one point when you were on Joan Rivers' show. I remember doing her show many years ago myself. But you're under the hot lights when she was a megastar at that particular time, and you caved.
I have both caved and raved, which is why I'm quick to say in that chapter, I got a pretty big log in my own eye here, okay? There is no way I'm going to cast the first stone at anybody who caves or anybody who raves. But I have learned the hard way that both of those extremes are unacceptable and ineffective. So a raver is someone who holds the right position but with the wrong attitude. That is basically a pharisaical approach to truth, basically one in which you say what is right, but you do it like Paul said we do when we speak without love, clang, clang, clang. A caver is one who is trying so hard to be a gentleman or to be winsome, that he soft-pedals truth or backs down when he ought to be clear and bold. So I used, for example, back in 1990 when I was a guest on the Joan Rivers show, and as you said, that was when she was, well, I think, at the height of her popularity, and I was asked on to come as someone who represented the traditional Christian viewpoint on homosexuality, and there was a gay couple there who claimed to be Christians, and they were there to say that we, in our attempts to help gays repent, we're doing damage to gays. And I mistakenly thought that my main job was to be the bridge builder. Well, I'm all for bridge building. I really am. But when that is such a high priority that we forget, no, our main job is to clarify truth with love, but to clarify it, whether it creates a bridge or not. People will choose whether or not they want the truth to be a bridge or they want it to be a battle cry. That's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to be clear on truth. So once I got there, I felt the hostility from her staff. I felt the hostility from the New York City studio audience. I was the fundamentalist boogeyman. So I felt the discomfort of that. That wasn't quite so bad, but once the interview started, I felt so tongue-tied as I realized, wow, I am having to answer hard questions about how the church has responded to this issue. I want to do my best to show a nice, gentlemanly face and not be accusative or judgmental. And with that as my high priority, I caved. I was just too nice. When I should have simply said, guys, what God has declared unclean, we must not declare clean, sort of a reverse of what God said to Peter. But instead, I tried to soft pedal it and say, well, you know, we don't want to judge people. I'm not here to condemn anyone. And I don't believe that homosexuals are all crazy. And so I was basically, instead of just saying this is wrong, which I eventually did, but not very well. So it was not one of my better moments, and that's one of the reasons I put it in the book. I wanted to say, hey, caving is not a new thing. Even poor Peter caved under pressure, and he was under pressure a lot greater than what I was under. But I think we have kind of a mental committee. We send things through when we are asked hard questions. And when we overdo that mental committee, when we have too many considerations, when we're trying so hard to weigh every little word we say in light of whether or not it'll be offensive, we don't do well. And that's the bottom line. So like I said, on occasions I've raved and on occasions I've caved. I hope that in the decades since then I've learned to present a much clearer and more balanced message. But on the one hand, I won't throw rocks at those who don't. On the other hand, I do think it's important to point out when people are caving or raving that they are wrong in doing so, and that more than ever, we need the clear Christian voice, unvarnished and unapologetic.
Yeah, you've learned your lesson. And in chapter 3, you actually talk about being served. You talk about the cancel culture and what it is. And I like the fact that you have some analogy for the cancel culture. On the one hand, people talk about the French Revolution and its comparison to what's happening in America today. On the other hand, you define this as more of a virus than a revolution.
Mm-hmm. A virus doesn't have a central organizing body the way most revolutions do. I see a lot of parallels between what we see today and the French Revolution. Certainly, the unreasonableness of it, the violence of it, the bitterness that gets translated into social action, that's true. But a virus is more something that spreads from person to person. Let me give an example. Hank, I've read different accounts of the Salem witchcraft trials. And one common element I see in all of the descriptions is the viral nature of these lies the girls were telling. A girl would hear another girl say, ooh, I saw Goody Proctor with the devil. Did you? Yeah, sure I did. Did you? Oh, yeah, I saw her too. Oh, we all saw Goody Proctor with the devil. And you basically send that through the echo chamber, and person after person is realizing, hey, it's kind of cool, and it's expected of me to say, I saw Goody Proctor with the devil. So that's what we say. And a lot of attention came with that. Of course, these girls got a lot of status for being the witch identifiers. And so even though lives were destroyed because of these lies, that virus, that madness spread among them. Now today, people are, I think, being infected with this virus that basically says, if people hold to the traditional views of marriage and family and social justice and salvation, they are hateful people. And when people hear that repeated by different people, they catch the virus and say, oh, yeah, me too. I also believe that these people who hold these views are hateful and they must be silenced for the good of the culture. And face it, that kind of makes you feel virtuous. If you are one of those who is saying there is a holy cause that I need to be a part of to stamp out intolerance and hatred, therefore I'm in, you sort of feel that pumped feeling of the righteous crusader. Now, in this age of, what else can you call it, Hank, but intellectual laziness, when people don't check things out, they hear something and it appeals to a need they have to get involved. So rather than check out the merits of the claims, they just jump on the bandwagon. And as a result, I think we have a lot of people who are very committed to cancel culture, the woke movement, the social justice warrior movement, extreme groups like Black Lives Matter, Antifa. All of these are basically symptoms of this virus, which people are being infected to think they must take action at any cost to silence people who hold unacceptable viewpoints. I got to say, in our nation, this is something fairly new, and I don't think we were well prepared for it, but, you know, here it is.
You've pointed out that the cancel culture is not easily defined, so you've characterized it in a sense. But you've also noted that today it's so dangerous because it wields the force of academia, social media, journalism, entertainment, public rioting, corporate influence, political leadership. So you have all of these forces that are arrayed to bring people in line. There's a potency to the cancel culture that is actually draconian.
Mm-hmm. It is, because it relies on intimidation tactics. Look, when one group publicly attacks another group by silencing them, rioting against them, basically trashing them, that not only limits the ability of that group to speak, it also sends notice to all the other groups. You're next if you hold the same views this group holds. And this is exactly why I think a lot of people, Hank, in our nation and in other nations as well, are not speaking out against cancel culture, not because they agree with it, but because they're afraid of what it could do to them. And as a result, a lot of people are simply allowing cancel culture to attack certain groups, the idea being, if I don't say anything, they will leave us alone. So you've got that sort of cliche. People say that the tragedy happens when one third of the population is oppressing another third of the population and the other third of the population does nothing. Well, that's how tyranny wins. And I think that is what we're seeing in this whole new modern version of tyranny.
Talk about the horror of 2020, not so much about the incidents themselves, but there's something more sinister going on behind the incidents. In other words, there's institutional approval of wicked evils. And all of this is being repurposed or reinterpreted as peaceful. All of this is violence in the name of, quote-unquote, social justice.
Hank, I'm glad you asked that. I sat in front of the television with my jaw dropping to the floor when I saw the rioting, the vandalism, the takeover of cities. Not because I was so astonished at violence. I mean, we've all seen examples of violence. But what horrified me was the unwillingness of local governments, local agencies that should have been enforcing the law, leaders who should have been enforcing the law. What was horrifying was to see them just stand there. In many cases, not only just standing there, but saying, that's good, I applaud that. And then even if they applauded it, they pretended that it was something other than what it was. So you would see a city, for example, taken over, and you would see a mayor say, oh, well, it looks like they're going to have a summer of love. For heaven's sake, the city was taken over. People were virtual hostages in their own homes. That's not a summer of love. And yet, politician after politician, talking head after talking head, community leader after community leader said, these protests are peaceful, even as the buildings are burning, even as the citizens are terrorized and in many cases assaulted. These protests are peaceful. The cause is just. There's nothing wrong with this. And you conservatives are making a big deal out of nothing. Now, this to me, Hank, is reminiscent of the way Hitler's regime took over in Germany. Not only did they begin openly persecuting Jewish people, but when Jewish people objected, why, the powers that be in the Nazi propaganda machine would say, oh, Jewish hysteria again. My goodness, these people overact. They cry persecution at the drop of a hat. And this was being done even as Jewish people were being beaten and denigrated in the streets. Well, I don't want to be too quick to compare anyone to the victims of the Holocaust, and I don't want to be too quick to pull in the Holocaust illustration. But what the heck are we supposed to do when we see that fairly recent history being repeated? And Hank, I think, you know, I am not one to say, oh, let's do anything we can to avoid persecution. That's not the point. I think that persecution is inevitable to some degree. I accept that because that is a fact of life in this fallen world. But when we allow persecution, which limits our ability to do what we are commissioned to do, of course we should be speaking up rather than just sitting there passively letting it happen. I don't think there's any honor in persecution that could have been prevented. So if we are sitting here as American Christian citizens in particular, simply saying, well, I don't want to get my hands dirty with politics. I just want to pray and trust that everything's going to work out all right. I have to wonder, for heaven's sake, do you think there would have been an American Revolution if our ancestors had felt that way? So for all of those reasons, I think that we do have the greater horror, not just the horror of people acting up outrageously, that happens, but the horror of the people in authority saying, oh, that's okay with us, and the rest of us feeling like, well, if you're not going to defend us, we are at the mercy of the mob. Now what? That's what I call a horror story.
Yeah, I want to camp out on that for just a moment because you have a chapter in your book titled You've Been Starred. And I was thinking about that chapter title when I was reading a book called Sarah's Key. I don't know if you've ever read the book. There's also a movie out by the same name. But for people who don't know about this book or movie, this takes place in real history during World War II, where the French police, at the behest of the Nazis, are rounding up Jews in France and then ultimately sending them to Auschwitz. And you wonder, how is it possible for the French people to watch these Jews being rounded up and then do nothing? And the answer that is given is that these Jews have become not just unwanted, but they've been labeled dangerous. And once you make that transition, it becomes very easy to look on apathetically as someone is being sent to Auschwitz because they are a cancer, they're a danger. And you make the point, You've Been Starred, that's the chapter, you make the point in that chapter that a lot of similarities are going on in the cancel culture today. People are not just saying that Christianity is wrong, but that Christians are patently dangerous.
And that's how you get people either riled up against a group or indifferent to a group. Either one will serve your purposes. Nobody, Hank, is going to get excited about it if the forces in cancel culture say, oh, those Christians are stupid. Oh, those Christians are jerks. Oh, those Christians are ridiculous. Oh, well, who the heck cares if somebody's stupid or ridiculous or a jerk? You don't really want to take action against them. But if you can convince people that somebody is dangerous, now you've whipped them into action. I remember taking my son to watch Beauty and the Beast when that first came out way back in the early 90s, I believe it was. And there was a key scene where the villain Gaston wanted to whip the villagers up into attacking the beast. But in order to do it, he couldn't just say the beast is ugly. Who cares? So he had to make up this long narrative about how the beast is a predator who's going to come at night and attack your children and destroy the village. And based on that alone, he had the whole village going out with torches to invade the castle and kill the beast. Well, that's basically the same tactic we're seeing today. I'm not saying necessarily that cancel culture seeks to kill us, but what I am saying is it certainly seeks to kill our ability to communicate our message and thereby attempt to kill the message itself. And we're seeing this played out, as you said, in academia, certainly in social media, in the corporate and professional world. Now, it's already true that a number of law firms and medical establishments and psychiatric establishments will not accept graduate students from Christian universities because the Christian universities will have held to doctrines about family and sexuality that these firms are saying are no longer acceptable. College professors, university professors, did grief. They face unprecedented pressure to walk the line when they address issues of racism and gender and sexuality, and students as well who just want to graduate, who want to get their degree and move on and establish a career, they're put in a terrible situation if they hold the traditional viewpoint on these issues because on the one hand, they want to be able to be in an environment of a free exchange of ideas. On the other hand, they know darn well they are not in such an environment. And if they are found out to be conservative Christians, or for that matter, Orthodox Jews, why, they could find themselves unable to graduate with decent grades, or at least to be harassed. So for all of those reasons, I pointed out in that chapter, we are experiencing something similar to the starring of Jewish people. Because remember, Hank, the star is not just something that identified people as Jewish. It came to symbolize every negative thing Germans had been taught about Jewish people. So the indoctrination came before the starring. The propaganda machine had to convince German citizens that, hey, these Jewish people, and not only German citizens, occupied citizens of other countries, it had to convince them these Jewish people are dangerous. They're unclean. They are predatory. They're greedy. And many of the evils that you experience in life, why, they came from the Jews. And when people are taught that, then you start stripping away the rights of the Jews. People aren't going to be very excited about it. Either they will be glad you're doing it, or they will be indifferent to the Jews. And that is what we're seeing today. No, we are not being shipped off to concentration camps. No, at this time, we are not experiencing the horrible treatment the Jewish people received when Hitler took over. But what we are seeing is the limiting of the rights of citizens who hold traditional views, and only the most naive will believe that it's going to stop there. And again, my concern is not that you and I and all Christians have nice, comfortable lives, Hank. My concern is that we be able to do what we have been sent here to do. And so I want to work while it is yet day, and if I still have a voice as to how the culture operates, which I still do, and you do, we all do, I want to use that voice as a good steward of truth. And then, if we've been faithful, and we've done our part as the light of the world and as stewards of truth, and God still allows us to be in a position where the church basically has to go underground, well, then all right, so be it. But it will not have happened because of our passivity. It will have happened because of human evil. And God is basically saying, I will allow you to go through this dark time. There's honor in that, but there's not honor in the first.
You have some wonderful alliterations in your book. You talk about misrepresentation becoming mistreatment. And the example with respect to Christians are myriad. If you can call a Christian a bigot, a sexist, a misogynist, a deplorable, then ultimately the public will offer little resistance to Christians being maligned or canceled. You also have, though, an alliteration which takes in sort of the universal perspective, reproach and reward. And in essence, what you're talking about is that this life is a drop in the ocean of eternity. So reproach in this world is temporary, heaven is eternal, and to be reviled is just part of a disciple's life. I really appreciate that dual perspective. On the one hand, we're being misrepresented, and therefore there is persecution. And I don't think we gloss over that. I mean, 8 out of 10 people who are persecuted in the world today are Christian. There are over 300 million Christians being persecuted as we're doing this podcast. I've mentioned those statistics before, but they are glaring. When you think about it, 250 million Christians are being persecuted at this very moment. So this is a very real phenomenon. But if you cast this in light of eternity, then we get perspective.
I think that brings to mind the early apostles being beaten and actually rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer. Now, believe me, I say that carefully, Hank. I have never been beaten for the sake of Christ. I have no idea what these billions of believers are going through as we speak. So I don't know what I'm talking about, really, when I talk about persecution of that kind. But I have to keep in mind, I denied myself the chance to be reproached for the sake of Christ when I did that darn TV show with Joan Rivers, because what basically happened was I was reproached because I did a lousy job. I caved. I was vague. I just bungled the whole thing. So I didn't win any friends anyway. But what a blessing it is, and I have experienced better in life, thank God, when you speak the truth and people despise you for it and you realize, okay, they have not rejected me. They have rejected the word of God, and I'm not going to get a martyr's complex, but I'm going to rejoice because I am in good company now with him who was taken outside the camp and bore our reproaches. And I think this is something we need to really lock into more in our thinking, Hank, is that if we are reproached for the sake of the truth, we are being given an incredible honor. Now, I do not say that we should sit there and allow ourselves to be persecuted if we can avoid it. But when it is unavoidable, and when even reproach, which is not necessarily persecution, even when that happens, I think we have to keep in mind we're accustomed in this country to kind of being on good terms with the world. I mean, the church and the world in America, the world has never been the church, I know that, but there's been a friendlier relationship, certainly. And so I don't think we've been prepared for hostility and opposition. And I think that has left many of us kind of like people who grew up in a neighborhood that was always nice. You could always leave the door unlocked. You could walk down the street at 2 a.m., nobody would hurt you. And then the neighborhood changed and it started getting more crowded and more violent people moved in and gangs started to show up. And all of a sudden you find that you're not safe in your own home anymore and you're not used to that. You haven't a clue how to defend yourself. I think that's where we're sort of finding ourselves now. So now more than ever, I think it's the age of the apologist. We are going to have to learn, all of us, to stop leaving apologetics to Hank and a Graf and CRI, but to understand that all of us can know the Word of God well enough to have a working knowledge of it and to defend the faith and to make a reasoned defense. I think that's our challenge today.
Joe, you mentioned just a moment ago the word hostility, and that's a word in one of your chapter titles. Chapter 5 is titled, Why the Hostility? And you do a wonderful job there, again, with alliteration. You have three C's, convenience, conscience, and conviction. I want to broach each one of those C's, convenience. Whenever truth is told, someone is going to be inconvenienced.
Well, that's always been true, hasn't it? I look at the Gospels and I see that when Jesus would speak truth, the truth he spoke became quite an inconvenience to the Pharisees, to the scribes, to people who did not want any challenge to their authority or to their error. And because of that, Jesus became quite an inconvenience. I think this will always be true, and it's certainly true today. We are an inconvenience, Hank. We didn't ask to start a fight. We really didn't. But there are movements today that are trying to convince the culture of what we all should believe. The transgender movement, the gay rights movement, the pro-abortion movement, critical race theory and the movement to promote it, progressive Christianity. All of these movements are full of some very committed people and have some very committed organizations behind them. And you better believe they have a lot of very powerful politicians behind them as well. What's in the way of those movements? Us, the church, because we hold viewpoints at odds with the goals of those movements, and that makes us an inconvenience. And in a broader sense, I'd have to say this. One thing I think all these movements have in common is a desire for expanded government, and I'm not trying to get overtly political, just realistic. If you want an expanded government, you are going to fall in love with all of these identity movements, because all of these identity movements call for government support. They call for bureaucracies, for investigative bodies, for cases going before court, for more attorneys, for more education in the schools, for more bureaucracies to see that the education happens, for corporate training and intervention. So anybody who wants expanded government, my goodness, they're going to love all of these movements, because these movements look to the government and say, we have an agenda, enforce our agenda. And I thoroughly believe, Hank, that plenty of politicians who do not even really believe that a man can become a woman, or that an unborn child is not an unborn child, or that men and men can form a sexual relationship every bit as honorable and as healthy as one formed by a man and a woman. I think plenty of people are giving lip service to those movements who don't even believe in them, but the movements are certainly convenient to the goal of people who want expanded government, whereas a healthy church is no friend of big government, because in a healthy church, our allegiance will only be to God. We're not troublemakers. We're not trying to be anything other than good citizens. However, no, we will not bow when the king rings the bell. We will not say that Caesar is Lord. We will not swear our allegiance to anyone but God, and we will not bend the knee when the government tells us to give lip service to basic moral beliefs and principles that we cannot give lip service to, which means that we become an inconvenience. So that's one of the reasons I believe there's hostility is the convenience factor.
You also talk about conscience, and I'm reading from your book right now, and this is what you say. Whenever I see people lashing out against voices echoing a truth that they want to repress, I can't help thinking about Stephen's hostile audience, the adulterous woman's guilty accusers, or, and you elaborate on this in the book, Poe's tortured, terrified killer, the role of conscience.
Yeah, it was kind of fun to get to talk about the telltale heart, Hank. I hate to admit it, but the first full book I ever read as a child was The Selected Works of Edgar Allan Poe. I don't know what that says about me, but it says something. But I was always struck by that story. The telltale heart, of course, is a cautionary tale about a man who committed a grisly murder, and his own conscience was testifying against him when the police came to ask him a few questions about the person who had been killed. He mistakenly thought he heard that person's heart beating under the floorboards where he had buried the body. And he thought that the police also heard the heartbeat, but they were mocking him by pretending not to hear it. And so he finally, on his own, ripped up the floorboards and said, "Stop this game. I admit it. I killed the man. Here's the body." All because of his wounded conscience. Now, in a, I guess, more redemptive narrative, when Stephen preached, we know that many of the men who heard him were, according to Luke, pierced to the conscience, pricked in their conscience, because he basically pulled out the law of Moses and the history of the Jewish people, and he showed them that by their own standards, they were guilty of the blood of the Messiah. When Jesus came to the aid of a woman caught in adultery, he basically said, "Of course, you can put her to death, just as long as you yourself have no sin in your own life." And it looks as though he did start enumerating on their sins, and one by one they left. Here's the point. When my conscience is bothering me, Hank, I have a choice. Listen to it and conform to what it says I should do, or silence it. The problem is, if I'm trying to silence my conscience and you come along and you start verbalizing what my conscience is trying to say to me, now, not only is my conscience my enemy, you are my enemy. And that is exactly why I think many people are so committed to silencing the Christian voice. I got to say, especially on sexual issues, not just on sexual issues, I know, but I think that there is such a thing as God-given intuitive consciousness. I think intuitively there are things we know, even as non-believers, a sense of right or wrong. It doesn't mean that we are saved, but it means that we have a sense that some things are right, wrong, normal, and abnormal. And I'll just say it plainly. I think we intuitively know, Hank, that when a woman is carrying a child, that's a child. I think intuitively we become gentler in her presence. We become deferential. We become protective. I think that we know if you are born with male anatomy, that is what you are. And that is what you will continue to be no matter what you do surgically to yourself. The DNA is still going to say exactly what was said when you were born. It's a boy. I think we know that. And I think when we try to push that down, as I did myself, I think that that's when we start seeing people as enemies. Because when I was trying to adopt a gay identity and when I was trying to live out my life as a quote-unquote gay Christian back in the late 70s, early 80s, my own conscience was testifying against me, and whenever anybody would come to me and say, Joe, are you sure this is right? That person became my enemy. Of course I lashed out. So I think that that is behind a lot of the resistance we're seeing to the Christian voice today. I think it's behind a lot of what is called hate crime legislation or banning of so-called conversion therapy or laws that basically prohibit freedom of speech and religion in other countries and also in our own. I think it's the problem of a wounded conscience that is demanding the silencing of anyone who is coming into agreement with it.
I want you to weigh in on the word conviction. You say it would be a mistake to assume that hostility towards biblical truth springs only from an inconvenienced agenda or preconscience. There are also those who oppose out of deep conviction. In other words, they're true believers, and they're completely convinced that what we hold to as Christians is deeply dangerous, and therefore there's a warrant for silencing a Christian.
Yes, I think in these days of cynicism, Hank, we're too quick to think that nobody has any sincerity, that if people hold views other than our own, well, they know they're kidding themselves. They must know they're wrong. They're just playing games, and they just don't want to admit it. Well, that's true sometimes, but it's not always true necessarily. Saul of Tarsus was a true believer, wasn't he? I mean, that guy believed in what he was doing, so much so that he said when he himself was on trial, hey, I have lived all my life in good conscience before God. I got to tell you, I salute anybody who could say that, but he was certainly wrong, even though he had a good conscience. And I think that was true of, well, it was true of the maniacs who flew their airplanes into our building on September 11th. I think it was true of cults like the Charles Manson family. I think it's true of people I've known. I remember meeting some folks who were with Reverend Moon's church, and they were intelligent, and they were in many ways likable. But when we would get to this whole concept of whether or not he really is a messianic figure, my goodness, these people really believed that. So I think that in some cases, yes, some people are opposing us just because their conscience is bothering them. Yeah, some other people find us to be politically inconvenient. But some people have been convinced, and if I could add something to that, Hank, I think people, especially young people, have a real need to be a part of a noble cause. And I get that. I remember that. I remember I'm 66 years old. When I was a boy, the civil rights movement was still relatively young, and there was still open segregation in many parts of America. And I saw footage of Dr. King marching and the people marching with him. I was just a little kid, but even as a little kid, I thought, wow, that's awesome. That's noble. I remember later in high school learning about the Holocaust and about the European underground that sheltered Jewish people and transported them to safe nations and resisted the Nazis. And I thought, how awesome to be a part of a noble movement. Now, in a noble movement, you have a group to protect, and you have villains to resist. And when somebody tells young people, hey, there's a group to protect, somebody's being victimized, and there are villains to resist, these are the bad guys. These days, a lot of young people will just jump on that bandwagon and go, okay, count me in, without even really examining whether or not that cause is a just cause and whether or not the claims being made are accurate claims. So I think that there is such a thing as a true believer. Now, the true believer may be uninformed, may be deceived, may be completely wrong, but that doesn't negate the fact that she or he is a true believer because, you know, often they are.
You mentioned the word abortion just a bit ago. In your book, you discuss abortion. I fear that a lot of people have abortion fatigue. They've heard about abortions over and over again. This has been a subject discussed in Christian circles for a long time. And it's sort of like, okay, Joe, why do you have to devote a chapter to the subject of abortion in a book on cancel culture? Why is this such a quintessential issue in your view?
Well, it's a quintessential issue whether or not cancel culture was even related to it, Hank. Abortion is just as harrowing, as evil today as it was in 1973 when our Supreme Court greenlighted it and had always been prior to that. When innocent lives are being taken, it remains horrendous, whether or not the horrendous nature of the crime has lost its shock value. I completely agree with you. I think we've got abortion fatigue, but I think that was all the more reason to write a chapter on it because cancel culture does indeed want to silence a pro-life viewpoint or a pro-life voice. And the irony of that is, I understand on the one hand, after all these decades, yeah, abortion, everybody's heard it, and it's an old issue. On the other hand, technology, I believe, is more of a friend to the pro-life movement than ever before. It is harder today than ever to argue that that is not a human life, a separate human life within a woman's body. And it is ironic in the extreme that we proclaim the value of all lives. We proclaim the value of women. We proclaim the value of children. And we find it so important to stand up for the oppressed and continue to destroy, to take away the chance for existence of the most vulnerable among us, the unborn. Now, full disclosure, just for whatever reason, integrity's sake, I guess, as with the caving issue, Hank, I myself fathered a child who was aborted. Back in the late 70s, I had an affair with a married woman, and that culminated in her becoming pregnant. And she had an abortion with my full consent and full support. And I am disgusted to say I didn't give it a second thought. And ironically, a few years later, when I was involved in full gay activism, when I was on staff with a gay church, and when I identified myself as a gay man, the woman who really enlightened me about abortion was a lesbian activist who also happened to be a nurse. And we were both socially liberal. We were both openly gay. We both were sort of on the right side of all the politically correct issues, except this one, because she said, you know what? I will never scrub for one of those again because I have seen what abortion is. And it's a barrel full of dead babies. And it's murder. I don't care what else they call it. I've seen it, and I can never be part of it again. And she is the one who got me thinking about what actually happens during an abortion, which, by the way, is something that most people who talk about it have not even thought about in much detail, which is exactly why I think there's such cultural resistance to ultrasound testing for pregnant women in crisis pregnancy. But for all of those reasons, I think that however tired we may be of the subject, we cannot lose sight of the seriousness of the subject. Is it a losing battle? Well, in the sense that, yes, every time that an innocent child is killed, we're losing. But I think we still will answer to God for whether or not we have at least spoken up for the oppressed. And on my own part, I kind of go along with what David said about his son when he lost his child, he can't come to me. I'll go to him. I will see that child someday, but in the meantime, I'm never going to be okay with what I participated in, and I think that I would not wish that on anybody else. So I hope that we are not so fatigued by the subject that we will stop talking about it.
Yeah, just deeply moved by what you just said. There's something else, though, that I want to get into, and you do get into in the book, and that is the history of Roe. The narrative with respect to Roe has been communicated so often, repeated by so many talking heads, that people think that this is actually a settled issue, that Roe v. Wade settled this issue of abortion long ago, but they have a faulty view of what actually happened historically with respect to Roe v. Wade.
Well, there were decisions made prior to Roe v. Wade, of course, which were interpreted as granting or even finding within the Constitution rights to privacy that were not really there. And I think Roe v. Wade is a classic example of the fact that a bad law, a bad decision, sets a bad precedent, which gets interpreted later down the line. And as a result, you come up with more bad decisions and more bad precedents. And good grief, there you have the tragedy that we're facing today. So I do think that Roe v. Wade is not as settled an issue as people try to make it out to be. It was a 7-2 decision resting on an alleged right to privacy, and that was not a right found in the Constitution, but it was a right that somebody else had articulated in a decision, I believe, almost 10 years earlier than that. And based on that, somebody said that that has been now found within the Constitution, and it has its root in the 14th Amendment. And because of that, we are going to establish a right to privacy, and we will consider the woman's right to abort as being covered under that right of privacy. But as I tried to point out in the book also, Hank, as you said, this is not a settled issue, and not just by conservatives. There are plenty of liberals who have said, you know, this was not nearly as black and white as people have pretended it to be. In fact, no one short of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said in 1985, and I'm quoting here, the court presented an incomplete justification for its action. The court's Roe position is weakened by the opinion's concentration on a medically approved autonomy idea to the exclusion of a constitutionally based sex equality perspective. So, the fact that something is done, even the fact that something is approved of by a large percentage of the population, does not mean that the issue is settled. Not at all.
And I think something else that you point out in the book, if I recall correctly, is that Roe v. Wade was about abortion in the first trimester, not in the second two trimesters.
Yes, exactly. And by the way, that was an important point, because the inference that you get from many people who talk about abortion is that Roe basically approved of abortion at any part of a pregnancy right up until the end of the pregnancy. That's not true at all. Now, I want to be quick to say, I don't want to parse this so much that I would imply that the child is less of a child during the first trimester than during the third trimester. I'm only saying that it's often a misinterpretation of the fact when people imply that Roe v. Wade legitimized abortion throughout the course of a pregnancy, when in fact it did not.
That was so interesting. I remember Carl Sagan, when he was alive, talking about how if you abort in the first trimester, you're aborting a creature. That creature eventually becomes a child, but certainly not in the first trimester. And that was his way of rationalizing abortion being legitimate in the first trimester, but not later on. And of course, as you've correctly said, a child is a child from the moment of conception. I mean, that is not a theological contention. That is pure scientific evidence. I mean, the evidence points in that direction. I think it's incontrovertible. But a lot of people say to you, Joe, what right do you have to write a chapter on abortion? You're a man, you don't have a uterus.
No, but I have humanity. The question itself implies that abortion is strictly a woman's issue. It is not. It is a human issue. If you are a human, you have the right to an opinion and to voice your opinion on this issue, because this has to do with women and men. Aborted children are both female and male. Now, it is true that women carry the children. That doesn't mean that men are not responsible to play a part in protecting the lives of those children. So in a way, I really, by the way, get tired of that line of thinking, Hank. People will sometimes pull out the status of the arguer to discount the argument itself. Well, you're straight. What do you know about homosexuality? You can't talk about gay rights. Well, you've always been comfortable as a man. You don't know anything about transsexualism. What right do you have to talk about transgender? Or you're a man. What right do you have to talk about abortion? That implies that abortion is strictly a woman's issue. I do think it's ironic that such a high percentage of the most powerful pro-life voices historically have been female, not just male. But again, this is an issue that affects all of us because it is about human beings. So to say that because you're a man, you cannot speak for the unborn would have been just as stupid as somebody saying during the civil rights movement, you're white, therefore you cannot stand up for African Americans. That's absurd.
Yeah, in your book, you also deal with a question that oftentimes, or at least a statement that oftentimes is made, and that is, if your religion condemns abortion, well, then don't have an abortion, but don't tell others not to have an abortion just because that's the conviction of your church. And you do a great turn on this. You turn this argument on its head by saying that I doubt you'd ever say, if your religion condemns racism, don't be a racist, but don't tell others not to be a racist just because your church thinks racism is a sin.
I try to point out in that argument, Hank, what I think we all know. And that is, there are some sins that people commit that are essentially private sins. Does that make them okay? Of course not. Sin against God is sin against God. But not all sins directly harm an innocent party. So we have laws in place to protect people from being harmed by other people for that very reason. So, again, the argument is just as absurd as if somebody said, well, if your religion teaches you shouldn't be violent, then don't be violent, but don't stop somebody else from being violent. Yeah, right. So, again, I think that people are accustomed to squaring off into their identity camps to determine whether or not somebody gets to speak up about something. And one of those identity camps can be religion or the lack thereof, wherein people say, well, that's just a religious issue, so you have the right to practice it, but don't tell me what I have to do. Well, in most cases, I would not. Look, I believe you must be born again. And if you are not born again, you will spend eternity apart from God. That's a terrible thing. But I'm not going to try to force you to become a Christian. But if you're going to murder another human being, whether you believe it is right or not, I'm going to do what I can to keep that from happening. And I think that's the way most decent people, Christian or non-Christian, would feel.
You talk in Chapter 7 about churches that today are conforming to the cancel culture cult, and particularly with respect to homosexuality. You have the PCUSA, you have the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, you have Episcopalians, congregations formerly associated with Southern Baptist Convention, Assemblies of God, Vineyard Fellowship, and the list goes on, churches, denominations that are conforming to the cancel culture. How can this be?
You know, it's funny you say that, Hank, and that you asked that question. My wife and I just this morning were reading about Josiah's reforms and how he said, what the heck is this stuff doing in the house of God? Why are these idols among sacred things? What is going on here? Why did we allow this? And I think that's kind of the key word there, what was allowed. We have allowed in many cases for error to creep into the church. And in most cases, the error seemed less serious than it really was. I mean, just Hank, for example, take some of these churches like the Presbyterian Church USA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, and so forth. Before they decided to adopt a pro-gay position, something else happened. Something happened to their understanding of the authority of Scripture. Something happened to their understanding of how you come to determine what is true and what is not. And once you change your position that the Scripture is authoritative, then when you add to that, when you modify it, when you tinker with it, then the symptoms of that modification will be in the errors like the gay-affirming church or the pro-gay theology or the pro-trans theology, for that matter. But I think that is basically what happened. If you show me a church that is now flying the rainbow flag, I will show you a church that before it flew that flag, it began denigrating the authority of Scripture in one way or another. The one logically follows the other.
You know, in preparation for doing this Hank Unplugged podcast with you, Joe, I watched a film this morning that's titled Pray Away. And at the very beginning of this film, in caps, it says reparative or conversion therapy is the attempt to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity by a religious leader, a licensed counselor, or a peer support group. And then it says, again, in all caps, flashed across the screen at the very beginning of the film, all major medical and mental health associations have denounced the practice as harmful. It also notates that approximately 700,000 people have gone through some form of conversion therapy in the U.S. alone, and that a national survey found that the LGBTQ youth who experienced conversion therapy were more than twice as likely to attempt suicide. And then the film is dedicated to those who survived this kind of therapy, and especially those, the film says, who did not survive it. The film is about Exodus International. You were involved with Exodus International. And essentially what this film is saying is that the leaders of Exodus had no qualifications and that they were fundamentalists who believed God created the world and that homosexuality is bad. What say you?
Well, I at least agree with those last few sentences. We did believe and do believe that God created the world. We also believe that God created humanity, that God created humanity with specific intentions, and that homosexuality is not one of those intentions. I believe our anatomy testifies to that. I believe the contrast between men and women testifies to that. And I believe the Word of God strongly testifies to that. Having said all of that, let me say that wherever you have effective propaganda, you'll have a combination of fear and exaggeration. Just for example, the film conveniently says some 700,000 people have gone through this thing called conversion therapy with no way of really backing those figures up or of doing any sort of assessment to determine whether or not that number of people have gone through such a thing. Secondly, conversion therapy is a very sinister term, isn't it? I mean, it conjures up the idea of a Frankenstein scientist creating some sort of monster or experimenting on people. So let's cut to the chase. As long as there are homosexual people, there will be homosexual people who come to Christ. And as long as there are homosexual people who come to Christ, there will be homosexual people who realize that homosexuality is not God's will. They will want discipling and support and guidance. That's what we provide. I have never met a Christian counselor or a Christian minister or Christian ministry who said the goal is to convert people's sexual desires from gay to straight. Our goal has always been to help people to live faithful lives, part of which will mean resisting desires that would take them outside of God's will. And then when the client has the potential for a response to a member of the opposite sex, and falls in love with someone of the opposite sex and wants to pursue that, of course we would encourage it. And if an individual does not feel attracted to the opposite sex, I would discourage that individual from entering into a marriage. So I think the misrepresentation is huge and grossly unfair. I got to tell you, Hank, I saw a movie like this a few years back called Boy Erased, and its portrayal of a ministry like mine was so harrowing. My gosh, in this film, the people in the ministry hit people with Bibles, beat them, held them underwater, called them horrible names, humiliated them, and degraded them in front of everybody. And I told my wife, man, if I did half the stuff they showed in that film, I'd pass a law against myself. So I think that the misrepresentation factor in these films is huge. But I will say this, too. None of us is above criticism. I am proud of the years I spent with Exodus. I considered it an honor to work with them. And I still consider it an honor to work with people who make a decision similar to one I made by the grace of God back in 1984. And that is, I want to be a disciple of Jesus and submit all parts of my life to him, my sexuality included. I never sought out change. I sought out obedience. That's what we're still doing. But watching this film, and I've watched it myself, Hank, I think that what we have to do is consider the criticisms that they are making and weigh whether or not the evidence backs them up. I do not recall Exodus International ever promising people that they would be free of their temptations, and I believe this film implies that that's what we all did, and that is not true. I think the film implies that we all clung to a psychological Freudian theory on the nature and development of homosexuality. I do not believe that that is broadly true. I think there were some with Exodus who did adopt a neo-Freudian approach, and I think that in some cases that approach was applicable to people, but never was it viewed as having more authority than the scripture itself. I think that people are portraying this type of ministry. In this film in particular, they're portraying this type of ministry as coercive and as repressive. And that's especially ironic to me because I know in the work I do and the work I've seen other ministries do, people come voluntarily saying, I believe homosexuality is wrong. Will you help me to live my life in accordance with those beliefs? That's not coercive. It's not repressive. And if I may add one more thing here, Hank, my biggest disappointment with this film is that here you have four people, and I knew all of them pretty well. I co-labored with them, and they were also good friends of mine. All of them at one time believed homosexuality is a sin. Now they are all openly gay or lesbian. Many of them are in relationships now, and they're all denouncing what they used to believe in. But not one of them in this film, not one, explained how they came to the conclusion that what they used to believe was a sin is now something sanctioned by God. Not one of them talked about how they interpret scripture now on the issue. Not one of them talked about how they themselves prayerfully studied the word and how they concluded that the word legitimizes what they are doing. They relied only on their experience, by which they said, I prayed for my feelings to go away. They did not go away. Therefore, I have decided that God intended me to have them. Well, good grief. Hank, that's a scary way to determine what God intended, because I can tell you a lot of things I feel every day that I sure don't think God intended me to feel, much less act on. So I think that that is a very faulty foundation, and the title itself is very misleading. Nobody in Exodus ever said, if you just go home and pray, all your homosexual temptations will go away. If we had said that, we wouldn't have been sponsoring conferences every year to teach people what to do with their sexual desires. So I guess, as you can see, I've got my opinion on this.
Yeah, and I think it's a good opinion. The title's misleading. The notion that what is being offered is equally misleading. But there's an end game here, and that is to tell the church what it can and what it cannot say. And I think that end game is something that we ought to be very aware of as Christians.
Hank, many people are naive to this, but they shouldn't be. A lot of people look at films like Pray Away, or they look at these bans on so-called conversion therapy, which none of us refer to as what we do, but regardless. And they think, well, those laws, those bans, those restrictions are only going to apply to these few ministers or counselors who do that kind of work. That's not true. Now, just for example, in Canada, I believe it was in Calgary, when a ban on conversion therapy was passed, the city council openly discussed the implications of it. And one of the council members said, okay, if we are saying that ministers cannot do so-called conversion therapy, what if a gay man goes to a church and says to the pastor, I'm gay, what does the Bible say? Can the pastor tell him it's a sin? And one of the council members supporting the ban said, no, he may not. Unless he takes a non-judgmental position on this, he could be fined $10,000 or face prison time. That's the end goal here. Because, Hank, think about it. If you call something a sin, and you're calling it a sin from a biblical perspective, you have to also be saying that sin can be overcome. If sin can be overcome, then a homosexual can change. Therefore, if you say homosexuality is a sin, you have to be also saying that a homosexual can change. Now, when we say a homosexual can change, that doesn't mean that he will lose all temptations or she will lose all desires. It means that the behavior can change, the identity can change, and the power of that sin in the person's life can change. Well, that's not acceptable to the people who are trying to shut down all condemnation of homosexuality. So what they're basically saying is, if you say homosexuality is a sin, you are practicing conversion therapy. Therefore, all of the opposition to conversion therapy, it's not just being leveled at those of us who do this work. It's being leveled at every Bible-believing church that holds the biblical position on human sexuality. It's very naive not to recognize that.
A canard worth commenting on, you bring this up in your book, that Christians were wrong about slavery, they were wrong about women's rights, and now they're making the same mistake today about gays and lesbians. What's wrong with that generalization?
Well, I'm glad you used the word generalization. That's the first thing that's wrong with it. It's a generalization. What, all Christians were in favor of slavery? Not on your life. Good grief. The abolitionist movement was largely fueled by Christian believers, both in our nation and in other nations. It's also true in more recent history that segregation was opposed by many born-again believers within the United States. So right off the bat, it's an inaccurate generalization to say, oh, the Christian church has been wrong on slavery, or the Christian church was wrong on segregation, or for that matter, that the Christian church was wrong about women. The Christian church has largely, and I mean overwhelmingly largely, been opposed to the denigration of women. If you believe that men and women have different roles, you are not assuming denigration of either men or of women. But probably the broader problem with that argument, Hank, is something I think we all know. If a group or an individual was wrong in the past about one thing, it does not mean that that same group or individual must now be wrong in the present about something else. There is not one person listening to this podcast who has not been wrong about something. Not one. Are you really going to therefore abdicate your responsibility to take a stand on right versus wrong because you have been wrong in the past? I can't imagine that. So I think it's kind of a cop-out. Instead of taking the time to weigh the rightness or wrongness of something, now people are simply saying, well, you, the church, were wrong about some things in the past. And even if for the sake of argument, I concede at that point, which I don't concede, because the whole church was not wrong about these issues, I would say that even if a group was wrong about something in the past, it does not mean it is necessarily wrong about something in the present. It only means that a group could be wrong about something in the present. Well, I'll buy that. I could be wrong. Anybody could be wrong. That's why we say, okay, how do we determine what's right or wrong? Is there a verifiable source? Yes, let's go to the verifiable source to settle the issue. And for me, that does settle the issue.
Yeah, well said. Another intriguing title, Eternal Lives Matter. It has to do with discussing race. And one of the things you bring up right at the beginning is CRT, critical race theory. A lot of people are hearing about critical race theory. They really don't understand its roots. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, critical race theory actually has its roots in critical theory, which is a much older construct. It's the assumption that people are oppressed by their social structures and that to achieve their liberation, you need something more than objective knowledge. You need intuition to really emancipate the people who are oppressed by social structures. Who are the oppressed? Anybody who's in the minority. And that particular belief leads you to believe that whoever is in the majority is thereby guilty of imposing an oppressive structure on everybody else. Now, up until, I'd say, the last few decades, most people had not even heard of critical theory. And I think that that's because it was not directly affecting so many of us. As I said in the book, I did myself have some exposure to critical theory when I was part of the Gay Affirming Church, because at that time, there were many people who were committed to feminism and towards ending racism. And they held the belief, based on critical theory, that anybody in the majority was guilty of the oppression of the minority. Therefore, all whites were racist and all men were sexist. And that if you denied the fact that as a white you were racist, it was only because you didn't want to take responsibility for the racism that you benefited from. And so that played out even, as long ago as the 70s when I was a part of that movement. But it's just within the last few years, with the development of Black Lives Matter critical race theory, which basically teaches that racism is systemic. It has infected every part of American life, and thereby all whites who benefit from white privilege, and if you are white, it is predetermined that you benefit from white privilege, all whites are thereby complicit with racism. Whites, therefore, must first acknowledge their own racism, and if they are unaware of it, they need to do the work to educate themselves and to listen to critical race theory and study it, admit their guilt, and then, having done so, they need to take action. They need to vote for the right candidates. They need to support whatever the current goals of groups are, like Black Lives Matter, whether it's defunding the police or whether it is re-educating the masses or whether it is redistribution or one of the latest ideologies is equity as opposed to equality. Equity, making sure that everybody basically has the same amount, that everybody is basically dealing with the same level of financial independence, the same level of opportunity. It's basically a way of saying everybody should have the same amount of everything. And with that kind of a very broad socialist agenda, the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to re-educate Americans to believe that racism is one of the primary issues we have to deal with today. Now, having said all that, no rational, much less decent person can deny that racism is evil, right? I mean, it's not bad, it's evil. Bad is if you do 75 miles per hour on the freeway when you should do 65. Evil is to believe that one race is superior to another. So that we can agree on. But as I argue in the book, it is unfair and illogical to presume people guilty of a sin unless they have practiced that sin or expressed affirmation of that sin. If one of those two isn't present, you have no right to call somebody guilty. And a biblical view of sin is just that. It basically says we are all sinners, that we must accept. But we are not guilty of a particular sin unless it can be shown by our actions or our expression that we are either committing that sin or approving of that sin. And this is what is tearing this country apart as we speak, Hank, is the fact that a lot of people in racial minorities are being taught to accuse those who are in the racial majority, and those in the racial majority are feeling more and more defensive and helpless and wondering what to do. So in polar opposition to what Dr. King said he dreamed about, a time when his children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Now it is being presumed that the color of one's skin does determine the content of one's character. Look, if that isn't racism, I don't know what is.
You know, that sounds a lot, Joe, like white-splaining. I say that tongue-in-cheek, but what does that term mean to you?
Good question. Well, let me go back to critical theory itself, because critical theory is sort of the mother church to critical race theory, queer theory, feminist theory, trans theory, and so forth. Critical theory basically teaches a Gnostic approach to truth, that you intuit what's true, you feel what's true. Don't confuse me with the facts. When you get into facts and statistics and clear definitions, now you're white-splaining. Now you're relying on verifiable logic to prove your point. So the word white-splaining, it basically is meant to shame white people from having an opinion, just like the argument, well, if you're a man, you can't talk about abortion. Well, if you're white, you can't understand racism. And what's especially racist about that is not only that it is a form of prejudice against whites, but I think it's a terribly prejudiced thing to say about racial minorities as well, because the implication is only whites rely on logic and verifiable fact. Well, good grief, what does that say about all other races? That they are not logical? That they don't rely on verifiable fact? That, to me, whether intended or not, is a terribly racist position to take.
You know, before we move away from this, Joe, I want to just maybe ask you to comment on one more thing here, because this is a macro issue. There's a lot at stake here. People see so many separate issues and they're not tying them together properly as you do in the book. We're talking about broad-based re-education, defunding the police, reparations, wealth redistribution. All of these are part and parcel of something that's being foisted on us. And most people don't know what that train that's heading directly for us actually looks like.
Well, I think there is both the natural and the supernatural backdrop to what we are facing. I think on the one hand, this is a setup for a tyrannical form of government. Because if you turn people against each other, if you establish that the government must step in to ensure social justice, if you take away people's rights to independent thinking, if you shut down the concept of free and open debate where ideas can be challenged and exchanged and defended and rebutted, if you take all of that away, then whoever has the power is going to step in and say, okay, new sheriff in town, we're in charge. Because one thing you notice about all of these, Hank, and I think you brought it up earlier, whether it's critical race theory or transgender theory, transgender goals, gay rights, the pro-choice, pro-abortion movement, these movements all have a monolithic feel to them. If you are not for us, you are against us. If you have not adopted our way of thinking, your voice must be shut down. Your rights must be limited. That means that one group promoting these ideologies wants to basically take over. That's a big government takeover, and it is a form of absolute tyranny. And I guess in America, we cannot conceive of such a thing happening in this nation founded on the concept of liberty. But I am not speaking as a historian. I'm just speaking as a guy who's read a few books. It seems to me that human history finds this, the tyrannical form of government, to be very much more the norm than the exception. This is where human nature generally leads people. We have muted the voice of the Spirit of God through the body of Christ. We are muting the voice of the Spirit of God through the body of Christ. We are muting the influence of the church and the culture, and as a result, somebody's going to fill that void. I mean, I was thinking about this, Hank, when I saw cities overrun last year and people just basically running riot and this mass anarchy, and I thought, you know, this kind of thing never lasts for long. somebody's going to step in and say, okay, I will take charge and I will end the confusion. And I think this is, again, where we are headed as a culture if we allow this to continue. I think the spiritual implications are ginormous, because I think that if I hated humanity as Satan does, I would not want life to be conceived. I would do all I could to prevent normal conception, whether through homosexual coupling or sex change operations. I would try to prevent that. If life was conceived, I would try to prevent it from being born. I would celebrate and promote abortion. If it had been born, you better believe I'd do everything I could to keep it from being born again. I would water down the gospel. I would promote a social justice ideology like the critical race theory to teach people that salvation comes through the social gospel, through people working for a better society, and making that their definition of salvation, because then nobody's going to deal with a sin issue and nobody's going to be saved, because if you're sick, you don't need a doctor. If you don't need the doctor, then you don't need salvation. That is how I would keep humanity where I wanted it if I hated humanity. And this is why I feel so strongly that these issues covered in the book, Hank, are primary issues. They are not secondary issues. They get to the heart of what God intended for the human experience. If we surrender these issues, then I really think it is hopeless and we have lost.
Yeah, you have such an important chapter on transgenderism, which you've alluded to several times in this discussion. And you talk about a playbook with respect to transgenderism, and that playbook that follows the playbook of the gay acceptance, how that was advanced. And it's very, not just interesting, but I think it's informative and it's very important that people understand what's going on here, because there's a shift, a subtle shift that's taken place, maybe not so subtle, a shift from asking whether transgenderism is normal to whether objections to transgenderism are normal. And now this shift has eventually moved all the way to an entire country like Norway passing a bill outlawing private remarks against transgenderism. So this is an important subject, needs a little unpacking.
It is an important subject. And as you said, Hank, I think as a movement, the transgender movement has very successfully followed the playbook of the gay rights movement. You will probably remember a time when we were still wondering whether or not it really was normal for men to couple sexually with other men or women to couple sexually with other women. Now, if you question the normality of that, you are the one who is abnormal. You're the homophobe. So to question the normalcy of homosexuality these days is considered so controversial that that makes you the person needing treatment. Now, the same is being done of the transgender issue. When I was part of the gay community back in the 70s and 80s, Hank, most everyone I knew, myself included, we considered transsexualism to be a disorder. I mean, we didn't view trans people as our enemies, but everyone I knew thought, man, if you really feel that you're trapped in the wrong body, something's wrong with you. Well, those days are gone. The transgender movement has jumped on the bandwagon and on the playbook of the gay rights movement, in that the gay rights movement basically said, first, stop telling us there's anything wrong with us. It hurts us. It causes us to hate ourselves, and it causes us to commit suicide, and it causes people to hate us and commit acts of violence against us. And so the public said, oh, you're right. We don't want anybody beating up gay and lesbian people. We don't want you to be hated. We don't want you to hurt yourself. So, okay, we'll stop saying it's abnormal. So the American Psychiatric Association reclassifies homosexuality. Movies start coming out normalizing homosexuality. The school system starts teaching kids that homosexuality is normal. Problem solved. Well, with the transgender movement, they basically looked at those tactics and said, us too. Stop telling us that it's abnormal to feel the way we feel. Now, you notice that that avoids the debate over the thing itself. Instead of saying, let's examine whether or not a man can really become a woman or a woman can really become a man, Let's instead argue over whether or not it hurts transgender people to say that transgenderism is abnormal. And by so consistently saying it does hurt them, the APA now has reclassified transsexualism and has renamed it gender dysphoria. Now, this is similar to what the APA did with homosexuality. The APA in 1973 reclassified homosexuality from a sexual disorder into something else called egodystonic homosexuality, which meant that if your homosexual feelings were at odds with your worldview, that was the problem, not homosexuality itself. And the same is true of gender dysphoria. If you have gender dysphoria, the problem is your feelings are creating discomfort within you because you feel like you're in the wrong sex. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It only means that the feelings cause you discomfort. And in many cases, the solution then is to change your body to match your feelings. That was a clever reclassification. And again, it took its cues from the gay rights playbook. Movies have come out, of course, over the last 10 years or even longer, normalizing transgender people, normalizing the transgender condition itself, I should say. And, of course, the school system has jumped on the bandwagon to the extent that now male-to-female transgenders are told that, yes, they are allowed to compete against or with girls who were born girls, female from the beginning. And the school system is teaching students that there is something wrong with them if they think there is something wrong with the transgender identity or experience. In fact, it's almost becoming chic, I gotta say, for kids to say they are either transgender or non-binary, because there is such a status attached to that, that kids are seen as both victims and survivors just by virtue of saying I'm transgender. Oh my gosh, you must have had a poor life. We need to afford you more dignity than you've been afforded, and you get a special status as a result. So for all those reasons, I think you gotta hand it to transgender advocates. They are committed, and they are bold. And you know what, Hank? The majority may not agree with them. I really don't believe the majority does. But that doesn't matter. What matters is who's the most committed. And these folks are nothing if not committed.
Yeah, they are committed. One of the points that you make in the book, and I think it bears elaboration, is that body parts can be changed, but DNA cannot. So transgenderism, in essence, is impossible because you can't become the opposite sex.
That's the point. I mean, you can have cosmetic surgery, and that's all it is. Seriously, it is cosmetic surgery. I believe that as a result, you have only disfigured your body, but you have not become what you may now appear to be. If you were born biologically male, you will never ovulate. You will never carry a baby. If you were born biologically female, you are not going to produce sperm. It's simply not going to happen. And your DNA is going to remain male or female according to the sex God assigned you at birth, which is really what we're talking about here. But I think that, again, the transgender movement is similar to critical race theory in that it places value on intuition more than on facts. In fact, people who object to critical race theory are often told, just as you said, oh, that's a lot of white splaining. You're just spewing out facts and statistics, and that's a very oppressive way of looking at this. Well, the same is true of transgenderism. If you say the obvious, well, excuse me, if you still have male DNA, then you are still male, people will call that, oh, that's transphobic. You're not taking into account what the person feels, and you need to validate that. So it really, to me, Hank, at least, sounds like Gnosticism.
Yeah, it is a lot like Gnosticism.
The emphasis of the intuitive over the verifiable.
Yeah.
And Gnosticism, of course, is based on, at least largely, on the idea that the creator who created us is flawed. And therefore, what the creator created us may be a mistake, and it is up to us, through our intuitive knowledge, to correct the creator's mistake. I think, in that sense, transgenderism is a very ancient error.
I have a couple more questions for you. Again, a reminder to everybody listening in. The book is titled Christians in a Cancel Culture, subtitled Speaking with Truth, and grace in a hostile world. The book available for all who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. Joe, again, the title, Christians in a Cancel Culture. Is there a sense in which the cancel culture is becoming a replacement for traditional Christianity?
Yes, I believe it is, Hank. I believe it's becoming a replacement because it preaches absolute truth. And it encourages an evangelistic fervor, a zeal, a commitment to be a disciple of the tenets and the goals of cancel culture. So in that sense, yes, I am pretty sure it does not claim to be a religion, but I believe it is in its own way a new religion, and it is a religion demanding not just obedience from its followers, Hank, it demands obedience from people who may not even believe it. That's the difference between cancel culture and Christianity, isn't it? We certainly believe in what we promote, and we would love to see other people believe it, but no, we are not going to oppress people if they don't believe it and try to coerce them into giving lip service to what they don't believe in. Cancel culture will do both.
Yeah, some of the quotes from deep within the Christian community. I think of Rob Bell, who was entrenched in the Christian community. I know a lot of people who followed him religiously, so to speak, who hung on his every word. He is now saying that he has long wondered if there was a massive shift coming, a massive shift in what it means to be a Christian. And then he says, something new is in the air. There's a fresh approach to faith, complete with new priorities, something that you call a pretty poison.
Yeah, I got to say that what you just quoted Rob Bell is saying is one of the very few things he said that I agree with. I do agree something new is coming. I do agree that in many people's minds there is a revision of what it means to be a Christian and what Christianity itself is. The big difference between Rob Bell and I is that Rob Bell celebrates that. I fear it and I regret it, but I do agree with it. I think that we are seeing a whole new approach, a deconstruction of sound doctrine and the erection of falsehood. And I think that is something Rob Bell and many others who I would call progressive Christians are fully in favor of.
Your last chapter is so important. It's titled One Last Stand. And in that chapter, you observe that the window of opportunity to openly speak the truth is, in fact, closing. And that is a reality check for all of us, isn't it?
I think so, Hank. And can anybody really deny that? We can look at the direction we are going and the velocity at which we are heading that way. And of course, the longer you are going downhill, the more speed you pick up, so the more ground you cover per minute. And I think that barring a miracle, the window of opportunity to speak truth is going to close so tightly that yes, we will still be able to speak it, but in a very limited way. I think even in the most rigidly controlled environments where you have an underground persecuted church, people still speak truth, which, good grief, we've got to do. I'm not suggesting that the time is ever going to come when we will be literally unable to speak the truth, but we will be unable to speak it without some pretty severe consequences that we haven't imagined so far. But I do think that what we have to do now is take seriously what Jesus said, work now while it is yet day, because the night is going to come when no one can work. And I think that what we have to figure is, let's first and foremost be about our Father's business. If we're going to take this one last stand, let's get back to the basics. What does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a disciple? What does it mean to be the church, the body of Christ? And how do we best fulfill all of those job descriptions while we can? and then to what extent we can challenge, debate, reason with those who promote cancel culture. Yeah, let's do it. Absolutely. But I think we have to realize that there will always be some very powerful forces, some very powerful governmental and social and academic and journalistic and culturally influential entities that are going to oppose us. And their forcefulness is only going to increase as I see it. And so I think we'll have to accept the fact that we are laboring while it's yet day. We are wanting to, first and foremost, preach the gospel, and secondly, make disciples. And as I said in the book, you can't do either one of those if you're silenced on these issues that we've been discussing. So I think that to what extent we can, we want to oppose the forces of cancel culture while still trying to reason with those who support cancel culture and speak truth, disciple people. And, you know, when we stand before the judgment seat of Christ, I mean, Hank, I'm not going to answer for how well my words were received. I will answer for how faithfully I stewarded the words I was given to steward. That I will answer for, and that's where I have to keep my focus.
Yeah, and you end this book with the powerful words that fidelity to truth brings peace, but it won't eliminate pain. And that, oddly enough, the vilification of truth is also its verification and its vindication, that truth cannot be canceled, even by the most aggressive culture. Joe, this is a terrific book. I've read the book through twice. I was just talking to my son, David. He said he's read it three times, so he's one up on me. But this is one of those books that covers so much detail, but in the most helpful way. I think the organization of the book itself is helpful. You have a section in each chapter, or virtually each chapter, about keeping it biblical, and then how we keep the conversation going. So the structure of the book itself makes it eminently readable, but also practical. In other words, you can take this book and not just read it, but put it into practice. You, again, have done a remarkable job, and this is precisely what we need. We need leaders. We need people who are not just able to sway a crowd, but leaders who are willing to take a stand for truth no matter what the cost. And you are one of those, Joe. I appreciate your friendship. I appreciate your work over the years. You've paid a price, but you're making a difference.
Well, that's high praise coming from you, Hank, and it's darned encouraging. Thank you. I was so glad that you liked the book and that you believe in it. I was hoping to write something that would equip people to do exactly what you are saying we need to do, to speak truth clearly with grace. And God grant that it be a tool to help people to do that.
Well, it is a tool to do just that. Again, the book is available for all of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with me. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. This particular podcast is reaching people around the world. It is amazing the kinds of reviews we get from different countries. Here's one. A five-star review by someone named Al. He calls this a real conversation, and he says, I feel as if I am a fly on the wall in Hank's lounge or a quiet pub where I can just listen and learn. Hank often interjects with a question, and immediately I'm like, that's what I would have asked. Again, your reviews are helpful. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward with anticipation to seeing you again on the next podcast. So long for now.